Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you. Hello, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name is Tom Marvin, Senior Technical Editor here at BikeRadar.com and at MBUK magazine as well. Joining me is Luke Marshall. He's one of our technical writers. How are you getting on, Luke?
Yeah, I'm all good, thank you, Tom. Not too bad. How about yourself?
I am A-OK. Yeah, looking forward to an afternoon of testing cross-country bikes out on my local tracks, ready for my next bike test for XC race bikes, which should be quite fun.
Sounds terrible. Sounds literally terrible.
I'm genuinely quite looking forward to it.
Why punish yourself?
Yeah. I've got some timber to shift after a bit of indulgence in recent weeks and months. So looking forward to putting some efforts in.
Being motivated by the last two weekends, XC racing in Brazil.
Oh, it's so good. It was so good. Yeah, I think the last weekend, the second round, I genuinely think four of the best cross-country races I've ever watched anywhere. It was amazing.
Yeah, no, fair play. I echo those comments. That was really good opening start to the season.
A month now till Novo Mesto, and what is it? It's only a couple of weeks till Fort William downhill, isn't it?
Yeah,
start of May. Amazing, really excited for it. How have you been, Luke? What's been cracking with you?
Well, I've been cracking bones, Tom. This is it. Unfortunately, I joined the club of the quintessential mountain bike injury and broke my collarbone. I was out riding the other weekend with my brother and his girlfriend, and just testing one of the bikes, or my long-term bike, and unfortunately, over the handlebars moment, and my forward roly-poly wasn't perfected, and did the typical collarbone break. So just recovering up from that. I'm going to be couple of months off the bike, but should all be good, back in time for summer and the dry trails. So
yeah, you've basically got, you know, like, it's been so wet this winter, it is gonna take 2 months at least for it to dry out and we get some proper buff trails. So I think you've just timed it to perfection.
Indeed. Yeah, no, it's all things considered, it's not causing me too much bother. So
okay, well, I'm glad to hear it.
Keeps me off the XC bikes, I'm fine.
You can't chip in with a bit of help. Oh well.
All down to you, Tom. All down to you.
That's fine. I'll survive. Right then. In today's podcast, if you haven't read the title of it, we are going to jargon bust some of the technical terms that we use in our mountain bike reviews, just to make sure that when you're reading them, you know exactly what we're talking about. So without further ado, we have 10 of them. So we'll start off with number one. And this one is all to do with suspension. And we quite often say suspension damping. What do we mean by this, Luke?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I guess the whole goal of suspension is to keep the tyres pressed into the ground as firmly as possible, as often as possible, so you've got maximum control for steering and braking. A suspension shock or fork is kind of, the internals are made up of a spring and what we call a damper. And if it was just the spring alone, then chances are the whole movement would be pretty uncontrolled. and your bike ride would be pretty wild. So a damper is basically a way of controlling the speed or stopping it completely of the spring's movement. So that's either in compression and rebound stroke. So this typically works by introducing, like, say, a hydraulic damper or hydraulic cartridge, which contains, well, most of the time, oil. And it's kind of how you force the fluid or the oil through the, like, different size and shape port shims and tunnels allows you to control the speed of the suspension. And that's going to allow you to better keep your wheels, tires in contact with the ground.
Okay, so we often sort of mention the damping circuits, and that's like the pathway that the oil will flow through, again, on the rebound or compression. Damping is a sort of a catch-all term for the control of the spring's stroke via the damper. And then sometimes we do use the word damper just to kind of mean the fork and the shock, you know, or the damper in the middle of the bike. Again, is like quite a broad term, but generally in that case, we mean the shock or the fork.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, it's often you call it a rear shock, but sometimes it does get substitute when you can't keep repeating shock, shock, shock in your flow and copy. So you have to put in another term. We might just put damper in there, but that generally is interchangeable with like shock or fork. Generally within each of those units, there is a damper cartridge or a damper circuit that is there to control how fast the spring will compress or rebound.
Yeah. Okay. And the damper cartridges themselves, they can be sort of quite complex things. And, you know, different forks and manufacturers have different names for them and they'll have different styles. So if you take Fox, for example, they'll have numerous different dampers or damper cartridges, which, you know, will be price dependent and genre dependent. So, you know, you might have a different damper in your XC fork to your downhill fork. But basically that is what a damper is. It's just the control of it. And they'll each do different things in slightly different ways. But it is a whole topic in itself because it can get quite complex.
Yeah, indeed. And Fox have just brought out for their forks three new dampers this year, discipline specific, to do with weight and complexity and the adjustments. But as a whole concept, then yeah, they perform the same function. How they perform it is a little bit different depending on what each suspension manufacturer deems as best or appropriate.
Well, let's stay with suspension and move on to the one that's actually at the bottom of our list, which is mid-stroke support. Now, this is something that is linked both to the damper, but probably more so the air spring or the coil spring that's in your suspension.
Yeah, it's a bit of both, really. So if we simplify it and talk about rear suspension, most enduro bikes, aggressive trail bikes, will be set up with around 30% of rear sag. Trail bikes, maybe a bit less, around 25%. But if you break a suspension stroke down into initial, middle, and end stroke, you almost got like 35%, 35%, 30% distribution of. So sag almost sits you at that borderline of like initial stroke and mid stroke. So when you're riding along on a bike, the suspension you feel most often is going to be the mid-stroke, your suspension through that middle portion of the travel, because your body weight's going to sit the bike to a sag point anyway, which is around 30% of suspension travel. So then further suspension movements from that are going to be roughly in the mid-stroke until you have a really hard impact where you'll get deeper into the travel and use the end stroke, which hopefully has got enough progression built into pride support. So that middle part of the travel, that mid-stroke from 30 to 70% or, you know, 35 to 75%, something like that, is really important because that's where you're the suspension you feel most of the time. And you want to have a combination of enough support through the damping and the spring to make sure you're not blowing through that travel too easy, but also that it's not too supportive and the bike feels harsh. So yeah, good mid-stroke support is different for every rider because everyone rides a bit differently and is a bit different for every bike, but you want it to feel supportive enough that you've got like a platform to push against and the bike doesn't feel wallowy and just robs all your energy and you can't maintain momentum down the trail. But then you don't want it too firm that it's just harsh and kicking you and the suspension is not actually doing its job of absorbing the bumps and keeping the tires in contact with the ground. So mid-stroke, yeah, it's a really important term, is one we use a lot to describe how suspension feels, because it's the way you spend the majority of your time.
Okay, and it sort of, as I say, links to how a bike kind of feels it's rolling down. You know, you could have like a super soft sofa-like ride, which has got quite an active mid-stroke with maybe support coming a little bit later on. But if the support's earlier on in its stroke, then it might feel a bit more peppy, a bit more sort of stood up, stay higher in its travel, maybe react better to pedal inputs, but might not be quite so smooth overall.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a compromise with everything in suspension. It's a compromise. You can't have the most supportive suspension and the most plush. You've got to find your balance. And I think it's probably pretty difficult for shock manufacturers and frame designers to find where they prioritize that suspension. I want to say feel again, but character.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Well, let's move on then to the next one, which is the term kinematics. Now, this isn't a term I'd come across before I sort of started working at MBUK Bike Radar 11 years ago. And it's certainly a word that I have typed many times. And it sort of generally describes the overall sort of performance and design of the rear suspension system, generally speaking.
Yeah, exactly. So how frame designers lay out their rear suspension system, whether they use a single pivot, four bar pivot, high pivot, whatever. All those different designs change, you know, the kinematics of the bike. And it's basically the relationship between how the rear wheel moves compared to how the shock moves, so the leverage ratio. And then it also determines things like anti-squat, so how well the bike may pedal, and then also anti-rise, which is kind of the brake influence of the system. And all these things get termed together in an umbrella term, which is called the kinematics, basically. But then there, between, like, throughout the kinematics, it describes the entire, like, suspension performance system.
So does it go into sort of the shock tunes and things like that, or is it more the actual physical layout of the suspension?
So it's more to do with the physical layout of the suspension, yeah. So, yeah, how the suspension pivots, bars have all been arranged within the system will give you the frame kinematics as such.
And it generally, it's an engineer who's designed this, not like a product manager necessarily. You know, they're quite technical things to sort of use. And there's, you know, bits of like online software or CAD software that is required for all of this stuff. It's quite technical stuff.
Yeah, yeah, incredibly technical. Yeah, these will all be designed by an engineer in collaboration with rider feedback and the brand's intent, you know, what they want the bike to feel like, how they want it to behave, what type of bike it's for, enduro, downhill. All these things will influence how they lay out the pivots and the rear suspension system they use to determine which kinematics are ideal for this application.
And so when they're designing the frame, obviously there's pivots, there's different length tubes, there's shock locations and all this sort of stuff. And we come across frequently things like a four bar suspension system, or, you know, there's a few six bar systems out there, there's faux bar. What do we mean when we say, for example, a four bar suspension linkage?
Good point. So yeah, so a four bar is, well, a bar is a element in a suspension design. Four bars have four of them. A single pivot has two bars. And I'll try and explain them as best I can. So say your typical four bar link would be specialized FRS design. Mm-hmm. And you'll have the main frame would be one bar.
The front triangle.
Yeah. Front triangle, main frame. That would be one bar. And then you'll have a pivot point, the main pivot point down by the bottom bracket somewhere. And that will be connected by what we'd call the chainstay. And the chainstay will be a second bar. And then in the horse link design, such as a FRS or specialized suspension system, then there'd be a pivot at the end of the chainstay. And from that pivot up to what would be the seat stay, the seat stay would be the third bar. And then you have another pivot at the end of the seat stay that should be connected to the mainframe by a rocker link as such. And that will be the fourth bar. But this applies to if it's Santa Cruz's VPP or Propane's Pro 10 or Giant Glory's Maestro, which are like twin link designs. They're still four bar systems or pivots, DW4. So again, the main triangle is one bar. The lower link would be a second bar. And then they normally, well, these all have a solid rear triangle. Okay. And instead of it being broken down by the pivot up near the rear axle in a horse link, these twin links have a solid rear triangle, so that's just one bar. And then the upper rocker link would be the four bar. Okay, and these links can co-rotate or counter-rotate, but they're still four bar systems. Lately, like Atherton's bike, they've got their DW6 link, and that's a six bar. So effectively what they've done is have the chainstay attached to the mainframe, which floats on two links. So if you were to take just the chainstay, the two links that connect it to the mainframe, that would be a four bar system as such. Instead of the whole rear triangle, it's just the chainstay. But they've added a pivot point at the rear of the chainstay and added a rocker link up the seat tube. So in theory, now you've got what is effectively a four bar system that's then got two extra bars on top. So it comes to six bar. So in failure, they've added like a twin link design plus a horse link.
And it's good.
That was really good. I've only ridden one bike of theirs, the Trail 130 or the Atherton AM130, their trail bike. It's brilliant. So I'll be interested to try the longer travel ones and see if it follows suit. But so that's kind of, that's what we mean by talking about bars. Hopefully it doesn't confuse everyone too much.
No, I think it's good. And when we say rocker link, that is usually the little sort of almost triangular bit of metal or carbon that pushes the shock, the tail end of the shock, compresses the shock.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so we started off with talking about horse links and four bar suspension things where there's a pivot on the chainstay. But another thing we talk about quite often would be a faux bar, FAUX, as in fake four bar, or a single pivot linkage actuated design. What do we mean there? What's the subtle difference that we're talking about here?
So the subtle difference is that the rear axle is mounted to the swing arm. So in theory, all single pivot bikes are effectively two bar bikes. They have the mainframe, the pivot, and then the swing arm, and the axle is connected directly to the swing arm. And what you will see with a faux bar or a linkage actuated driven shock, such as the Marin ATAC system, I can't remember what they're called.
Multi-track,
sorry. So then you'll have an additional pivot on the swing arm somewhere that will then maybe go up to a rocker link that will drive the shock. But that pivot point, that additional pivot and those extra bars, they don't influence the arc of the real axle travel as such. It's not influencing the movement of the rear wheel. So it's still just one single swing arm attached to the mainframe. It helps brands to manipulate the leverage rate of the shock rather than having, as a traditional single pivot like an Orange would be, which would be just a linear leverage rate. So with this, they can add progression to it to give a performance character that they would want with their kinematic.
Okay, so you say kinematic, but you've also segued really nicely onto leverage rate. What is the leverage rate?
So basically, simple terms for it is the ratio, if we call it a leverage ratio, and it's the ratio between how far the rear wheel moves compared to how much the shock compresses. So for every maybe 5 millimeters the rear wheel moves through its travel, the shock will compress a certain amount. And the ratio of these two is called the leverage ratio. And how bike designers lay out their frame kinematics or pivot points, bars they use, whatever they want to design, determines exactly how the rear wheel moves in comparison to how much the shock compresses. And that's the leverage ratio. Most try to have a progressive leverage ratio, so it gets harder for the suspension to compress as it gets deeper in the travel. This adds a bit of support for big hits and bottom out events, and so you don't blow through the travel and end up just, bottoming out your fork or the rear suspension so much that you have to add a lot of pressure support at the start of the travel that you lose sensitivity. So this is how they manage to maintain initial sensitivity, get good mid-stroke support, and then add bottom out resistance.
Right, let's move away from the technical terms of surrounding suspension via very quickly, though, a quick look at suspension forks, and we'll just run them through the sort of the architecture of them. So you have the lowers, the uppers or the stanchion, crown, bushings and brace. The lowers, I think this is pretty obvious. This is like the lower structure on like a fork that slides up and down, connects to the axle at the bottom and goes up and down. It's the, on a Fox you know, bright orange fox bit, it's the orange bit of the fork.
Yeah, yeah, best way to describe it. Yeah.
It's the bit that sort of it's got the all the stickers on and looks fancy.
Yeah.
Okay, then you have the uppers, or the stanchions, which are the slidey, sort of very smooth, usually black or gold bits, and they disappear into the lowers, but they're obviously fixed in place, and they're connected via the crown.
That's right, yeah, top of the forks is good. The crown. Inside the lower legs, you've got the bushings, and effectively a fork is two different diameter tubes sliding in and out each other. So to stop them rattling around, these provide a surface that keeps the stanchion firmly in place, but then reduces friction enough that it will slide through to improve performance. But their job is to basically keep these two different diameter tubes from just rattling around uncontrollably.
And kind of running on the same plane so they don't bind.
Exactly.
You know, if you hit the fork at the front real hard, that you know the two sort of tubes might not be in the same, exactly the same path, and that'll bind and cause a bit of stiction or a bit of, well, that's friction, but cause a bit of binding. It'll make it feel a little bit harsh. And that's why you have ever, you know, bigger diameter forks on ever more aggressive forks. So a 38, for example, has a bigger stanchion and a big lowers than a, say, a 32, adds weight, but it also adds stiffness because you're going to be battering through the rocks.
Exactly.
And then going through the frame, we have the steerer tube that connects the crown effectively to your stem. So that goes up through the headset, up through the head tube, and then you clamp your stem onto that. And yeah, that's the steerer tube. Right. Let's move completely away from suspension. We spent a lot of time on suspension because it is obviously quite technical things. And it's like really integral to how a bike performs. So that's kind of why we spent so much time on suspension. But we're going to move away to a little bit of protection. First up, D3O. We sort of talk about this mostly in knee pads, back protectors and elbow pads. But I think D3O are going to be involved in some grips from ODI, but not the kind of D3O as you know it, but the people who make it. Anyway, D3O, non-Newtonian fluid. Quite interesting stuff. It's like a padding material that, as say, you generally find in your knee pads, and it's flexible and soft when you sort of touch it and manipulate it gently. But if you hit it hard, this non-Newtonian fluid stiffens up and it spreads that shock across a wide area, thus dissipating the energy without having like a sharp force on your knee.
Nailed it, exactly.
D3O is the brand. They supply their pads to a wide range of, you know, clothing and P&A people. So you'll find D3O pads in knee pads, back protectors and all that sort of stuff from a whole host of apparel brands. Their sort of signature thing is that it's bright orange for the most part. So if you see a bright orange bit of sort of soft pliable material within a knee pad, it's most likely going to be D3O. And our final one is MIPS. And this is something that we see in helmets. You know what it stands for, MIPS.
Yeah, so Multi-Directional Impact Protection System. And it was a system designed to try and reduce concussion causing forces through a crash. So helmets often get tested just in a straight impact test. But unfortunately, when you crash on a bike, it's not often you hit your head just in a straight impact way. Often there's quite a lot of rotation involved. And so the MIP system is designed to try and minimize any rotational forces that would lead to an increased risk of concussions or head injuries, basically. So it's a slip plane. There's generally a liner that's in MIPS is often yellow. I mean, there are other systems out there that MIPS has a yellow liner that is attached to the helmet on effectively elastic bands, which allows the MIPS liner to move in all directions as such. So the helmet shell can rotate relative to the padding and the rider's head, which helps then minimize the rotational force applied to the skull during impact event. And that's kind of its whole goal is, yeah, to reduce the possibility of head injuries and concussions in crashes.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's MIPS. It's generally found in sort of like mid to higher end helmets because obviously there is a license fee that manufacturers pay. So you might not find it in like the cheapest helmets, but generally speaking, we've sort of always sort of err on the side of it being a good thing to have if you can afford the sort of the additional premium in those helmets because concussions aren't fun.
No, never. I fortunately never had one, but I've seen people with them and it seems like a terrible time.
Yeah, not good. Right. Okay. So those are the sort of the 10 or 11 bits of mountain bike jargon that we have tried to bust there for you. So hopefully it's been a little bit of help. Next time you read a review on bikeradar.com of a mountain bike, if some of these phrases come up and you didn't really know what they meant before, you do now. If there are any other phrases that frequently come up in our reviews and you're not quite sure what they mean, do drop us a line, podcast@bikeradar.com, and maybe we'll do a follow-up episode in the future of some maybe slightly more technical terms. But yeah, do let us know if there's anything you've got any questions over. And of course, feel free to drop us some feedback, questions, comments. We'd love to hear from you.
Especially if we've just confused you for the last half hour.
Yeah, we'll send you a dedicated reply just to sort of iron it all out for you. But yeah, thanks ever so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll be back very soon with another episode of the Bike Radar Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar Podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.